Good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're watching from. Welcome to the most recent edition of the Scott Ritter Show. There's a lot going on in relation to the ongoing special military operation in Ukraine and in general. We have terrorist attacks in St. Petersburg. We have American journalists being arrested for espionage in Russia. We have the ongoing situation in Bakhmut, and we have the potential of a Ukrainian spring offensive. Who better to assist us than in trying to decipher all of this is than our guest today, Rodion Moroshnik. He's the I'm going to give him an opportunity to explain what his exact role is. He's somebody who was at one time was the ambassador of the Lugansk People's Republic to the Russian Federation, but since Lugansk has been absorbed into the Russian Federation, I think his title has changed. But I want to welcome him and to the show, and I look forward to our conversation. So thank you very much for joining, and if you could help us out, please explain what is your precise role today. What role do you serve? You used to be the ambassador. That's when Lugansk was an independent republic. But today, now that Lugansk is formally part of the Russian Federation, what role do you play?
Thank you so much for your kind invitation. That's a privilege for me to take part in your show because I heard a lot of very good things and we actually share a lot of thoughts. So what my status is, certainly, I am an ambassador, but I'm an ambassador of 2022 because the Luhansk People's Republic is now part of the Russian Federation. I'm an analyst. I'm watching all the major events. I'm dealing with the humanitarian projects and as for my future functions in Luhansk, the time will show how it will change. But now I'm telling people about what is going on in Luhansk, what is our attitude towards the processes taking place in Russia, and what processes are taking place on the front line and next to the front line. This is what I'm focusing on. I'm a co-founder of a project which is called Helping or Assisting Ours. We're helping the people who are living actually in the next to the frontline regions.
Well, thank you very much for that. Again, just to follow up on that, when we look at Lugansk today, of all the four newly acquired territories, I believe it's the only one that is close to 100% under the control of the Russian Federation. But there's still active combat taking place. But in February 21st, Russian President Vladimir Putin, in his address to the Federal Assembly, spoke of his priorities or the priorities of Russia. And he indicated that the development of the social and economic well-being of the people of the newly acquired territories, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk, was the number one priority. And it sounds to me like that's your role today, that you are looking out for the social and economic well-being. How much of a challenge is this to not only assist people who have been in a warlike environment for more than 8 years, but still are at war? I mean, when I read, I hear that settlements in Lugansk, towns, cities are being shelled by the Ukrainian forces, civilians are being wounded, being killed, property is being destroyed. And this is at the same time you're trying to rebuild Lugansk. Could you tell us a little bit about your work and how difficult it is to do your work under conditions such as this?
Let me describe the situation at hand that I now see in Luhansk. And you have correctly said almost the whole territory, 100% of the territory is totally liberated. It is under control of the Russian Federation. Before, it was controlled by the Luhansk militia, but now it's been controlled by the armed forces of the Russian Federation. But the northwest of our territory, that Lysychansk, Kremenai, Svatovo, They are next to the front line, and there are 24/7 hostilities going on. And despite the fact that we maintain the initiative and we may actually advance 100, 200 meters a day, and we destroy as much hardware and material that's been launched by the Ukrainian forces all the time, and all the time they want to recapture some of the territories. For instance, Crimea suffers a lot of shelling and strikes almost every day, and certainly this affects the humanitarian situation. About a week ago, I visited Crimea, and I must say that this city, despite the fact that we are fully in charge of it, we cannot restore it, we cannot rebuild it, because it's very difficult to supply water and electricity, and there is no communication there, because the city is always shelled. For instance, once we restore the power supply to hospitals or to some local administrations, kindergartens and schools, immediately the transformers would be destroyed by the Ukrainians. It means that they purposefully inflicted damage to these critical infrastructure pieces to make people suffer. So on the one hand, we want to evacuate people who want to do that, but on the other hand, as the practice show, about 30 to 40% of people living there next to the front line, they are reluctant to leave this territory, they are reluctant to leave their houses, they don't want to leave their land, and we try to help them with permanent convoys of humanitarian aid. We help the people who have little kids or whose elderly are ill, so our project supplies all the necessary commodities to these people, and we do that every 2 weeks. We sent a convoy of trucks to Crimea in order to supply most necessary amenities to these people in order to let them survive in the current context. Unfortunately, Lysychansk, Severodonetsk and Rubezhne are almost totally destroyed, and it is very difficult to restore an infrastructure there. So it means that Ukraine strikes these cities, preventing us from bringing necessary construction materials there. But there are even general plans designed for certain cities, how they should look like, and there are people who can start rebuilding these cities. But as far as there are daily shellings, it is not possible to do anything about that. But it doesn't mean that the whole territory of Luhansk suffers from that. The situation in the capital of Luhansk People's Republic, in the city of Luhansk, we made a lot of advances. So Luhansk is a twin city of Moscow, and for instance, Mosvoda Canal is operational in our city, and the residents of Luhansk, now that they are happy with the water supply to all the districts, which is totally unique for the city. At the moment, we are restoring the infrastructure, restoring bridges, because Ukrainian troops exploded and destroyed all the bridges there. Step by step, we restored a bridge to Rubezhne and Shastya. All in all, there are about 20 bridges which have been rebuilt thanks to the efforts of the military and the civilian companies which assumed that responsibility. So it means that where we can provide for at least relative security, we do a lot of rebuilding. We are restoring, really restoring everything, and we provide for integration, social and economic ones. And certainly this is not seamless. There is a shortage of many things, and people suffer from the fact that they cannot get Russian IDs promptly. But now President Putin issued an instruction requiring the migration services to create all the necessary conditions that the people living on those territories could obtain their Russian passports, their social benefits, and because without a Russian ID, this is not possible to be entitled to any social benefits. I do hope that this presidential decree would be executed and the passports would be issued more promptly, so that the people would really feel they are full-fledged citizens of the Russian Federation. Believe me, you can take my word, that people living in Luhansk and Donetsk and those territories, they appreciate very much that feeling of being part of that big country, because it took Donbass to get to there 9 years.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. On a related subject, you spoke of the ongoing violence. Again, going back to President Putin's address on February 21st, he spoke of the need to push the Ukrainian military back beyond the borders of Russia to the maximum distance of the artillery systems that they're currently bombarding Lugansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, Kherson with. This means offensive military action. But when I look at the front line in Lugansk, I don't see the kind of movement that would reflect that happening. Do you anticipate that the Russian military will be fulfilling the president's direction to push the Ukrainian military beyond the maximum range of their artillery? This would be about 100, 150 kilometers. That's a major undertaking. Do you anticipate that this would be happening? I have friends who have family in Lugansk, and they are shelled repeatedly, and they call me up and they say, when is this offensive that you keep talking about? And I keep saying I don't know, because I don't know, but maybe you do, since you're in a more privileged position.
Well, first of all, the offensive certainly would be, because no one has changed the objective that was put forward in the very beginning of the special military operation. Ukraine, as a toxic entity in that shape, will not let us live peacefully until we demilitarize Ukraine, our territory. However, we push the front line. However far we can push the front line, we will not be living peacefully. Therefore, not only we have to push the front line as far as possible, but the armed forces of Ukraine that are sponsored by the West, we have either eliminated them completely, or at least we have deprived them of the opportunity to undermine our security, so that they could not shell us. They should not be able to make a strike in years' time, on 2 years' time. We are not going to let them have a break. The situation is quite favorable for us because, for instance, in Artyomovsk, in Avdiivka, and next to Seversk, that's the cities of Kremina and Lysychansk in that direction, which we call Seversky and Krasnoliman area. We have to eliminate as many Ukrainian military as possible. We see that actually there is a lot of hysteria in the West. They try to supply as much equipment to the Ukrainian forces as possible. And certainly we'd like to destroy these weapons next to the Western borders of Ukraine, where we can reach it. But as far as it has reached us, we find ourselves in a more privileged position. For instance, in Bakhmut or Artyomovsk, which is the second name of that city, we are destroying the weapons there. And the military supplies, which have been sent to Ukraine, certainly will not change the balance of forces. But there is one more important thing. As a military, you can understand that clearly. Global offenses, large-scale offenses, would require proportionate victims. So let us wait. Ukraine cannot wait with its counteroffensive, because actually it is doomed to die. And we tell them, hurry up, hurry up. Start your counteroffensive, and we finally will put an end to all your attempts to make a breakthrough. You want to make a breakthrough to Melitopol or to Mariupol. You want to make a breakthrough to the Azov Sea. We are ready, actually, to neutralize or eliminate the military equipment which has been and military weapons which have been supplied to you by the West. We have all trained military and personnel who find themselves in a much better position in terms of their location. I think that we're going to wait until the Ukraine forces start their counteroffensive, at least this is what they call it, and I'm sure that it would halt, and after that we'll start our offensive. But I'm not a military, probably. You are in a better position to judge about that counteroffensive. I look at that from inside out, and looking from inside out, I see the morale of our military, of our soldiers, people who are ready to deal a final blow on Ukraine. So let them counteroffend, and that would be the end of it.
No, I agree with you from a purely military theory position. The the Russian military, which borrows its doctrine from old Soviet doctrine, always trained to receive the attack of NATO and then counterattack. And so it would be logical to let the Ukrainians expend their force in a spring offensive before launching a major offensive. But there's a major battle taking place right now in Bakhmut, Artemovsk. And some people, including myself, have likened this to, you know, some of the critical battles of the Great Patriotic War, the Second World War, a decisive engagement. If you listen to people such as Mr. Prigozhin, the director of Wagner, which plays a big role in the Bakhmut fighting, he has indicated that the Ukrainian army has been virtually destroyed because of this fighting. Do you share that assessment? Do you view the Bakhmut fighting as being one of the more decisive battles of this conflict? I'd be curious what you think.
I can tell you one thing. One thing that I'm 100% sure that Ukraine in the city of Artemovsk, Bakhmut, lost dozens of thousands of soldiers. Dozens of thousands of soldiers and thousands of military equipment. And the supplies which have been mentioned in Rammstein and which are mentioned in various countries of the West certainly will not compensate the losses suffered by Ukraine. Ukraine is totally actually is used not to take care of the Russian hardware, for instance, or Russian machinery. I think that in the city of Artemovsk, they deployed about 400 Soviet tanks, and now the whole world is supplying about 100 or 200 tanks. And Ukraine used to have about 400 tanks, and they all destroyed. Therefore, such supplies are more of a psychological nature. And Ukraine is paying for these psychological attempts. Zelensky believes that if he retains Artemovsk as long as possible, the more money he would be given. But the West says, we have given you enough. This is up to you, and it is high time to start a counteroffensive. You have signed an agreement. We have supplied hardware, we have supplied the weapons, and this is up to you to die there. I don't think that this will happen in Artemovsk, and this will happen in the South. And we see some symbolic nature of that. Ukraine, in order to prevent us from raising a flag in Artemovsk, they exploded the very building of the local administration of the mayor's hall. So they exploded that building to prevent us from raising our flag. But we can actually put the pole of the flag right onto the ground. And as many personnel we destroy, as many weapons we destroy there, the more efficient that battle would be. Because Ukraine trying to retain Artemovsk and trying to retain Avdiivka, and at the same time trying to bring about more troops in some other directions, has to supply more military personnel to Bakhmut and or Artemovsk. So it's a kind of a patchwork. And Ukraine doesn't want to start its counteroffensive, but the West would urge it to start it as soon as possible. We find ourselves in a more privileged position. We understand it, that understaffed army would be launched not to start counteroffensive, and it would be destroyed.
Thank you very much for that. I want to transition right now from military war into information war, but it's not war of words. We see some violence taking place. We know, for instance, last year, Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin, was assassinated by the Ukrainian security services. And tragically, just this past Sunday, Maxim Fomin, a very popular journalist, war journalist, a blogger who used the pen name Tartarsky, was killed in a terrorist attack. You know, he and Daria Dugina and others, including myself, are on a list known as the Mirotvorets list. It's a list that people who are on it are designated to be killed by the Ukrainian Special Services. When I look at that list, I see thousands of names, including hundreds of names of children, children under the age of 18, many of whom live in Lugansk, many of whom live in Donetsk, and their only crime is to speak out against the policies of Ukraine. Can you talk a little bit about this nature of the conflict, what it means? We focus on the military, where it's, in general, it's a fair fight between a soldier and a soldier. But now we're in an information war where one government has targeted for death civilians simply for the crime of speaking their mind. Can you talk about that and maybe talk about Mr. Tartarsky, Maxim Fomin, if you knew him, if you knew of his work, and what something like this means to Russia as a whole and indeed to the world?
You're absolutely right in your language, in your wordings. So this is a terrorist attack. This is not just a high-profile killing of a signature war blogger, renowned war blogger or opinion leader. No, this is a terrorist attack which killed Maxim Fomin and that injured more than 30 people who came to meet Vladlen Tatarsky, also known as Maxim Fomin. So it was a targeted terrorist attack to show that Russia cannot protect its own people, even in St. Petersburg, what is called the northern capital of the country. So a blow was dealt on the people who support the special military operation, who seek to defeat Ukrainian Nazism. And this is where the terrorist attack took place. I'm glad that our investigators and prosecutors now call that a terrorist attack and that the people who prepared that were the special forces of Ukraine. The information that we gain now show that the preparation took more than a week. That lady who brought an explosive to that cafe in St. Petersburg, she attended the meetings with Vladlen Tatarsky in Moscow, and a legend was prepared for her, and she actually made that burst of Tatarsky that exploded later on. She was an artist, therefore, she could do that on her own, and she could stuff that burst with some explosives and hand it over to Maxim Fomin. So, in essence, she handed over an explosive to Vladimir Tatarsky in order to heal him and to injure other people. Then that lady was dressed a very special way. She was in an overcoat, so probably it was an attempt to protect against the explosive splitters. Probably there was an armor under that overcoat. Anyway, she tried to escape the video cameras. Then for several hours, she was wandering around the city. She had another flat. And now the investigation committee said that actually she is telling the true story, and the traces are leading us to Ukraine. And there is one terrorist organization, a foreign agent, which does exist on the territory of Russia. She was a member of that organization, and she got to orders from Ukraine, where actually that organization was run either by Ukrainian or Western special forces. It was a very thoroughly planned operation. We understand it, that a whole range of organizations operational in Russian, in the Russian Federation can no longer be deemed an NGO as far as they are connected to the Western secret services. They have to be considered terrorist organizations aimed at dealing some painful blows on the Russian Federation. So therefore, we have to think about our own safety and security for people who keep track of that situation, for the people who are living in Donbass. What matters is how we are going to reciprocate. I believe that the Russian forces have enough capacity to counter-strike. We have to strike the decision-making centers that took a decision to kill Vladlen Tatarsky and Darya Dulgina. These centers have to bear personal responsibility. And I do think that our military can do that. no longer we have to adhere to some principles or some standards. When we say that actually this is immoral and we cannot do that, but now making a strike on an enemy, depriving the enemy of the possibility to take any decisions or to wage an information war, is of paramount importance. We have to destroy the decision-making centers. We have to be much tougher in the decisions that we take. Even we have to kill the individuals who are blatant enemies of Russian Donbas. I think that we will have to revisit everything in the memory of Daria Dugina and in the memory of Vladlen Tatarsky. We'll have to revisit our attitude towards counter-terrorist measures, how we deal with the foreign agents on the territory of Russia, and also we will have to revisit our actions on the territory of Ukraine, how we're going to penalize the perpetrators.
Thank you for that. Here in the United States, there's a lot of misinformation that goes around about Russia. And one of the key themes is that Russia and its leader, President Putin, is an autocratic nation, a veritable dictatorship that suppresses political opposition. And so when we take a look at the murder, the assassination of Maxim Fomin, and the relationship that exists between this terrorist, this lady who worked for Ukrainian secret services, and the Navalny organization, some people in the United States say that this is an effort by Russia to suppress political opposition, that they will exploit this this murder to destroy the Navalny group. But if the Navalny group is actually working with Ukrainian secret services to assassinate Russian journalists on the territory of Russia, are they really a political opposition, or have they become a terrorist group themselves? What's your opinion on this?
I think that in that situation, we have to make a difference, to tell one from another, to make a distinction between an opposition and influence groups. An opposition is a political force which act as patriots but dissent on how to act. And when the country suffers pressure from outside, they have to realign with us, standing shoulder to shoulder with their political opponents in order to protect the best interests of the country. But when the group is destroying their own country from inside, when they support such terrorist attacks, killings, assassinations, when they approve killing of outstanding people, these are not oppositioners, these are terrorists, the terrorists which are being sponsored from outside. These are the terrorists that are being run from outside. So this is just a sleeping cell. This is a network of sleeping cell. And certainly this is not a prosecution of or persecution of the dissenters. So the communists are in opposition, but the communists are protecting their own country. And probably they can disagree with the decisions taken by the local authorities. They can stand up against that, but they will never be part of any activities arranged by the foreign secret services. In that case, Navalny and his organization, a whole range of other people, these are foreign-sponsored groups which can be used in order to undermine the country's security against the people of that country. Therefore, this is by no means an oppression of the political opposition. Such a war situation requires a more stringent attitude to the foreign secret services that have created their own cells, their own groupings here on the territory of Russia. We have to destroy the agents, otherwise the war will not forgive us. We cannot afford having these subversive groups here on the territory of Russia, subversive groupings on the territory of Russia. I'm confident that our secret services would do their best in order to eliminate them. Opposition, that's good, that's a norm for a democratic society. But a network of terrorists, this is a deathly thing.
Thank you very much for that. Now, I want to go to another question that's related. You speak of the need to suppress the work of foreign intelligence services on the soil of Russia. Look, as an American intelligence officer, I agree. I don't want foreign intelligence officers working on my soil, and nor should you want foreign intelligence officers working on your soil. But when we have the level of problems between our two countries that we have, sometimes we might have a tendency to overreact. We're guilty of it. We arrested some Russian citizens, and we treated them very poorly, claiming them to be agents of the Russian government working against America when maybe their work was more innocent. Recently, there was the arrest of an American journalist for the Wall Street Journal. He was accused of receiving classified information. He's being charged with espionage. But when you look at this journalist, he has a long track record of being a journalist, of doing his job. And sometimes a journalist's job is inconvenient to those whom he reports on. Now, I understand if you're an American journalist in Russia, you have to obey the rules, you have to obey the laws, and that Russia has a different standard of free press than the United States. But do you think that this could be an example of the Russian government overreacting, being too sensitive about the work of a Western reporter? I understand we have to let the investigation play out, but it's a big story here in the United States. The President of the United States has let his feelings be known. Is it possible that the emotions of Russia, which rightly so, are very strong right now against any potential threat, but in this case, maybe there is an overreaction?
Now, I see that the West is overreacting, which immediately decided to whitewash a person who all of a sudden got interested in the confidential secrets in the country which is engaged in the war, which is at war with an indirect engagement of the West. So immediately the West said that he is innocent. So Russia has not said that he is guilty. Russia has said that there are some features proving that he is guilty and that our investigators are going to deal with that because there are some traces, some features attributable to espionage. And journalism and espionage are things different. When a person wonders how the military plant works, what secrets are kept and where, I'm confident that once such a person emerges at some Martin Lockheed plant in the United States, he would be immediately put in prison and the public opinion would be totally indignant why he's poking his nose into these affairs. And if they have learned that this is the Russian, then he would be brought to the state where the capital punishment is allowed, and he would be just executed immediately. I think that we have to be patient. And once there is no actual composition of crime, then he would be acquitted. But if not, then he would be condemned and convicted. And the most stringent measures would be taken. So that's a very severe situation. And I do not recommend to anyone to substitute the investigation, and I do not recommend to anyone to do anything that would look like an espionage.
Thank you for that. Look, it's a very sensitive topic, and as you rightly said, there's an investigation going on. He hasn't been found guilty of anything, and we should let the process play out. But as you know, we live in very strange times where patience is a virtue that not too many people possess, especially on this end. Let's talk about, though, information warfare continue on this theme. You live in Russia, and you know that the special military operation is a very emotional subject for Russians, that many Russians support the president, some Russians don't. What is the status of free speech in Russia today? Let's say I was a Russian citizen living in Moscow, loyal to my country. I'm not committing espionage. I'm not working for the any foreign service, but I have concerns about the special military operation. Am I free to express my concerns, or will I be arrested and will I be imprisoned?
Proceeding from the fact that you know that certain social groups of Russia treat the special military operation differently, you have answered that question. So they can express their viewpoints, they can express their concerns, and they would render their concerns through the social media and through the mainstream media. I took part in multiple talk shows, and never I was told that you can speak about that, but you cannot speak about that under the threat of penalty, death, or anything like that. If I'm concerned about the situation in the front line, I would express that despite proceeding from what I know, what I've learned being on the site, in the field, and I speak as I feel. I know that I have some opponents, and I have friends and people who would support me. And there are people who believe that actually the hostilities have to be escalated. It means that I have proponents and opponents, and once I have both of them, it means that Russia is a total democratic country in terms of the freedom of speech and how we cover the special military operation. Once we have a general approval and censorship, certainly, we will not say that the freedom of speech is good. In Ukraine, for instance, you cannot say that the Russians are justified in their actions, and probably the people of Donbas can choose what country to live in and in what church to make their prayers. In Ukraine, this is not possible, but this is possible in Russia. Therefore, we can say that we have different viewpoints, and we can come to terms in the process of a discussion or a debate. We can have debates, and this is a very healthy society when we can have different viewpoints.
I'm going to repeat your last statement just for the American audience watching or those in Western Europe. In Russia, you can have debates, and it's healthy for the society. You know, here in the West, we can't. It's not that it's a crime to have debates, but they won't permit the debates to take place. The government and the mainstream Western media only allows a certain narrative to be put forward. That's the importance of this show. This is why one of the reasons why I agreed to do something like this is to bring an alternative point of view. So I thank you very much for making that statement, and I hope the people watching listen to this. Before I let you go, though, I have one last question, and I'm going to ask you this not as your current status as a Russian citizen, but your former status as a Ukrainian citizen, as a citizen of Lugansk. There is a fundamental, I think, misunderstanding of the conflict in Ukraine today here in the West. I take a look at what's going on right now with the suppression of the Russian Orthodox Church. I take a look at the historical hatred that exists between the people of Western Ukraine toward the people of Eastern Ukraine. I take a look at the ideology of Stepan Bandera, which has taken control of Kiev, and I see a fundamental disconnect between Ukraine and Russia that is almost impossible to overcome. There's some people that speak about the need to heal wounds, to heal the damage, that in the future relations between Russia and Ukraine can't be defined by hatred, but have to be defined by brotherly love, Slavs and Slavs working together. Do you think it's possible for Russia and Ukraine to ever repair the damage that's been done by this conflict, by the hate that's been created. And again, I bring up the issue of the Orthodox Church. I don't think Americans understand the significance attached to the Russian nation, to the Russian Orthodox Church, and the pain that is accrued when you see the church being defiled as it is in Kyiv today. Could you give us a little bit of insight into not only the religious aspects of this, but as I said, the cultural aspects? Can we expect Russia and Ukraine, the Russian people and the Ukrainian people, ever to be able to peacefully coexist as friends, given all that's happened?
Before the war in Ukraine, I took a very high position. I was a vice governor. Therefore, I know how the authorities functioned there. But certainly, I cannot make up with the situation in Maidan, and which actually made our country turn in the wrong direction. In order to speak about relations between the Russians and the Ukrainians, or Russia and Ukraine, or Russia and the entity that would remain on that territory. First of all, let us actually remove the hands of the West, of the American government and of British government from that territory. Yet Ukraine pursue the national interests of Ukrainians. Let it not be a herd which actually follows the orders of its shepherd. Because when the people were deprived of their language, of their history, now the people are being deprived of their church, and it turns the people into a herd of sheep, and it is being run to the slaughtery. It's very difficult to ask questions to the people or to the elite, which is being fed by the Western rulers, whether they are ever going to make friends with Russia, with the Russian people, and what I think about the Slavic Brotherhood. So let us first unleash Ukraine, which makes Ukraine a puppet. Once we do that, once we get rid of these reins of the West, only after that we can speak about the topic that you have raised, because being so emotional, both parties will not respond to that question. I'm confident that our thousand-year-long history and Slavic origin, some spiritual unity, will help us to heal the wounds and to go on as a hand and glove. But now, once the people are being used as a herd, this is not possible to be done.
I want to thank you, Rodion Maroshnik, for coming on this show. Thank you for your words. Thank you for your analysis. Thank you for your humanity. And I just hope everybody who watched this show understands what a treat they had listening to you today. So thank you very much. And I hope to be able to see you again. And before we sign off, I just want to remind everybody of one thing that Rodion said. He talked about the people of Ukraine being a sheep. Looking to their shepherd, the shepherd, of course, being the West, the United States. Sheep often look at their shepherd as their savior. But in this case, we need to be reminded that the shepherd is merely guiding his flock to the place of their slaughter. And if you're a Ukrainian watching this today, I hope you can find some wisdom in those words and understand that you need to stop being the sheep. You need to stop trusting the shepherd, and you need to start standing up on your own two feet. Knowledge is power. Thanks for tuning in, and I look forward to talking to you again next week.